I don't believe there can be any doubt that the prospect of intelligent life existing in somewhere in outer space has intrigued scientists for generations, especially those of the evolutionary ilk. Some years ago, the late astronomer of Cornell University, Carl Sagan, raised private funds for a radio telescope that would search the skies for a message coming in to us from supposed extraterrestrial beings. And the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Organization, or SETI, as it is known, lost its funding as of April 2011 and began to shut down their operations. But by September of 2011, private donations were solicited and brought in enough for them to resume. Jodie Foster, who was the star of a 1996 movie that was about SETI, name of which was called The Arrival, was one of the principal contributors. The huge dishes that are seen on the eastern side of Highway 395, south of Bishop, California, are not part of SETI, but they were used in the making of the film back in 1996. Actually, the SETI dishes are more numerous than the ones along Highway 395, and they are actually in a place called Medicine Hat Canyon or something like that. But some people say, well, this is ridiculous. It's no wonder that the thing was going broke, because what's the big deal? I mean, are they really expecting to hear some kind of communication from outer space? And you may wonder, well, what's the interest in extraterrestrial life? Why do people spend and be spent in trying to pursue the search for extraterrestrial life? And we know, of course, that there's many movies have been made about E.T. and also about space travel, and you know, we all know how to speak Vulcan and everything like that. And but why? Why the interest in things like this? Well, there's several answers to this, and I want to start off by looking at some of these with you this morning. The first one is that there are some today who firmly believe in the existence of intelligent extraterrestrial life because they're convinced that if life evolved here, it not only could have evolved elsewhere, but must have evolved elsewhere also. You see the root of this. Again, Carl Sagan, who passed away in 1996, is just one example of those who were of that persuasion. And about 16 years prior to his death, he, in an issue of the New Scientist magazine, published these thoughts. He said, there are something like 1,022 stars in the universe, and as about one in a million of these stars is a yellow dwarf star like our sun. This means there's about 1,016 sun-type stars in the universe. Now, one in a million of these sun-type stars has a planetary system to that similar to that of our suns. Therefore, there are about 1,010 planetary systems in the universe. Now, remember that this is old technology, because we've discovered so much more since then that his figures to be highly exaggerated are highly underrated. In one in a million of these planetary systems must have a planet similar to that of Earth. And life must have evolved on those planets in the same manner in which it has evolved here on Earth. Therefore, there are at least 10,000 planets in the universe that have life. Now, that's logic, you see. This is good logic. But where is it root from? Listen to it. Where does it all start? Evolution. You got it, David. That's where it all starts, right there. A fellow by the name of Sir Fred Hoyle, who was a English astronomer and mathematician, noted primarily for his contribution to the theory of stellar nucleosynthesis. I can barely pronounce it and couldn't tell you what it means for sure. But he says in his book, life cloud with so many possible planetary systems, should we not expect inhabited planets to be moving around some of the nearby stars? Well, we certainly should. It's evident then that many evolutionists believe intelligent life exists on other planets. Why? Simply because evolution must work that way. You get it? You start with the assumption that evolution is so, and thus everything else has to conform to that. Now, that's not good science, by the way. But it certainly seems to make some people happy. Second, there are some who believe life will be found in outer space because life could not have just happened here on Earth. However, far from invoking a creator into this picture, their intended point is that simply based on available evidence that it indicates that life is too complex to have occurred here on Earth by purely naturalistic processes. This is a roadblock that the evolutionists run into constantly. The more we look into DNA and look into the various sciences, the more they shake their heads and say, you know, this is pretty hard to believe this just happened by accident. Just pretty hard to believe that this happened by accident. So they have to find an explanation for it. So what they come up with is life must have evolved somewhere in outer space and been planted here. Now, all of you, I'm sure, have seen the pictures of the runways where these interstellar creatures landed down in South America, or so they would have us to believe. At least Chariot of the Gods seemed to say that. But there again, that's fantasy. That is nothing but pure fantasy. We need to keep that in mind. Now, notice this particular, this is, by the way, Sir Francis Crick, who's an English molecular biologist, biophysicist, and neuroscientist. And by the way, he is one of the ones noted for the discovery of the structure of the DNA module. Okay, so this is no dummy we're talking about. Listen to what he says. It says in a volume dated 2004 of his called Life Itself. If a particular amino acid sequence was selected by chance, how rare an event would this be? Suppose the chain is about 200 amino acids long. That is, if anything, rather less than the average length of proteins of all types. Since we have just 20 possibilities at each place, the number of possibilities is 20 multiplied by itself some 200 times. This is approximately equal to a 1 followed by 260 zeros. The great majority of sequences can never have been synthesized at all at any time. You see what he's observing there? Then he makes this admission, and I want you to notice this one. An honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense, the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which it would have had to have had to be, or have had to been satisfied to get it going. Did you hear that? Almost a miracle. How did we suddenly go from atheism to almost a miracle here? Well, as I said, the more man finds out, the more man understands, the closer that they get to having to admit there's things they just cannot explain any other way. But while acknowledging that the impossibility of actual dental formation of life here on Earth, here's what it comes down to. He still refuses to accept the idea of an intelligent creator. And instead, he opts for what is called... What happened to my... Did it die? It's not that bad, is it? What's going on here? Oh, there we go. Now we're there. It's called directed panspermia. And that is the idea that life was planted on the Earth by intelligent beings from outer space. Now, this is what he concludes after saying it is almost a miracle. Almost a miracle. But he's not alone in this viewpoint, because there are many other British chemists and American scientists who believe the same thing. But now, the third thing we want to note here is that without a doubt, some evolutionists who are determined to believe in some form of intelligent extraterrestrial life are doing it because they're convinced that somehow this will nullify creation. For example, English scientist and writer and broadcaster Ion Ridpath, in a book called Signs of Life, says, "Religions which contend that God made man in his own image could be severely shaken if we found another intellectual race made in a different image." Did you hear that? Yeah, that's right. Jonathan N. Leonard, a Time Magazine science editor, also showing his disdain for the concept of creation in his essay called Otherworldly Life, says that scientists point out that there is nothing miraculous. Let me see if I got the right one up here. No, here it is right there. Go back. Nothing miraculous or unrepeatable about the appearance of life on Earth. Listen to that. Nothing miraculous or unrepeatable. Now, how does he know that? How does he know that? They believe that will happen again, given the same sufficient time and same set of circumstances, and would even happen under different circumstances. And thus, there is no reason to believe the conditions in the atmosphere and oceans of the primitive Earth were modified by any outside power, i.e. God, to make them favorable for the development of life. They just happened that way, and it is likely that life would have appeared even if the conditions had been considerably different. Now, these writers make it very clear then that they believe if extraterrestrial life were to be discovered, somehow we would finally be able to disprove the idea that there is a creator with concrete evidence. Now, with all of this in mind, what response should the believer in God offer to these evolutionary positions on the existence of intelligent life in outer space? Well, there are several things, and I have to be honest with you, I've been working on this for several weeks now, about two or three at least, and trying to narrow this down to one lesson, so I'm maybe seem to be moving fast, please bear with me. But whenever we consider here the positions that these people take, we need to look at this from the perspective of God, because we have evidence. We have evidence that God exists. And so with that idea in mind, what response should we set forth? Well, first, I want you to notice here that any claims made concerning the existence of life in outer space are just that, claims, and nothing more. They are nothing more. In their more candid moments, even evolutionists admit this. Did you know that? Philip and Michael Rowan Robinson, astronomer and astrophysicist at the University of London, said, "From the almost imperceptible wanderings of several nearby stars, we can deduce that they have small companions. But the masses of the companions deduced in this way are, with one exception, 1 or 2% of our sun's mass, that is, 10 to 20 times the mass of Jupiter. Such objects could, in fact, be tiny stars rather than planets, for they may be undergoing nuclear reactions in their core. This one exception of Barnard's star, the next nearest to the sun after the Centauri system, 5 light years away, has been claimed that the star has 1 or 2 companions of mass of about that of Jupiter. This is still a matter of dispute between astronomers. It is an act of faith based on rather shaky probabilistic arguments to say that other planets like Earth exist in the universe." Now, that is written by a person who believes in evolution. But you hear what he said? A fellow by the name of Freeman Dyson, in his classic text called Disturbing the Universe, that's kind of disturbing, wrote what he called the Philosophical Discourse Dogma, maintaining as an article of faith that the universe is filled with societies engaged in long-range philosophical discourse. The Philosophical Discourse Dogma holds the following truths to be self-evident. First, life is abundant in the universe. Second, a significant fraction of the planets on which life exists give rise to intelligent species. And third, a significant fraction of intelligent species transmit messages for our enlightenment. Did you get that? Now, if these statements are accepted, it would make sense for us to concentrate our efforts on the search for radio messages and to ignore other ways of looking for evidence of intelligence in the universe. But I'm sorry to say, this philosophical discourse dogma is far from self-evident. Far from it. Because there is as yet no evidence either for or against it. There's no evidence whatsoever. And, you know, these two evolutionists, though, have an excellent point. If there is no evidence for any of these grandiose claims regarding habitable planets, then what are we doing? Or, let me put it this way, why are billions of dollars of my tax money being used to find life on another planet? Does that bring it a little closer to home to you? And the more they spend and the further they go, the more they prove that there is none. Yet, here we are, spending all of this money in a time when our government is nearly broke. No, I'm sorry, more than broke, in debt. Okay? But we'll go on to the next point without going any further on that. The second point, the claims being made are often blatantly contradictory. Now, let me give you some example of this. A fellow by the name of G.E. Tauber, in a work called Man's View of the Universe, suggested that there are about a billion possible candidates in the galaxy alone where intelligent life could exist. This is 1 billion planets just on our own Milky Way galaxy, he says. Yet, listen to the estimates of Sir Fred Hoyle, who is says of the 200 billion or so stars that are in our galaxy, the Milky Way, about 80% fail to meet the conditions discussed as being necessary for life. The remaining 20% are not in multiple star systems and have masses in the appropriate range, 3/4 to 1/2 times the mass of the sun. The grand total planetary systems in the galaxy capable of supporting life is therefore close to 40 billion. Now, these two men are both discussing the same thing, potentially habitable planets in the Milky Way galaxy. Yet one places the number at 1 billion, while the other sets it at 40 billion. And these books were published in the same year. You get that? Let me tell you what makes me think of. You know a fellow by the name of Mark Twain and his work, Life on the Mississippi? You know what he said about this? He said, there is something fascinating about science. One gets such a wholesale return of conjecture for such a trifling investment of facts. And that just really says it. That really says it. That's what's happening here, isn't it? It's exactly what's happening. How can we expect to be able to accept as credible figures that are so vastly different from men who are all claiming to be believing and teaching the same things? Pretty hard to believe. Now, third point. Those who wish to convince us this excuse me, directed panspermia via some intelligence, there it goes again, in outer space, have failed apparently to understand that they have not addressed the issue at hand. They have merely moved it to another planet. You hear that? Well, we can't prove evolution here, okay? So let's do this. Let's take it to another planet. And maybe we can do it there. I don't know about you, but these people claim that creationists only see this as a problem, but that's not true. Even some of their own evolutionists find this as a problem. Listen to this. Fox and Doze, who are two evolutionists widely respected and figure prominently in the origin of life research, say that another criticism has been voiced is that moving of the origin of life to an extraterrestrial site also moves the problem to that locale. See, they can see that, can't they? Only by the broadest interpretation invoking organic chemical precursors can the site be stretched to such a distance. Did the intelligence that allegedly directed this panspermia evolve? Or was it created? We're right back to the same thing, aren't we? We're right back to the same thing. And we find ourselves saying again, whether there is intelligent life in outer space or not, does not answer the basic question. And the basic question is, where that life, or life on Earth, either on the planets in space or life on Earth, originated? We're right back to the same question again. Are right back to the same question. So really, they're desperate attempts to try and prove evolution through extraterrestrial means, if you will, falls flat on its face, doesn't it? It falls flat on its face. Now, finally, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever for life on other planets. Scientists have little choice but to admit this fact. It's becoming more and more evident all the time. Not too long ago, we had another example of this. The Mars lander. Now, this is going to prove evolution, you know. We're going to get on there. We're going to dig all this stuff up. We're going to find evidence. Your tax money at work, dear hearts. They didn't find anything. They didn't find anything. And what's funny about this is a brother in Christ, who's a good friend of mine, who works for NASA, said, and they won't. But he works with people who are convinced they will, because they want to prove evolution. By the way, this guy's a Hungarian philosopher of science and a systems theorist. Sounds pretty impressive to me. But fellow's name is Irvin Laszlo, and he says the search for life, especially intelligent life outside the confines of our home planet, has always fascinated poets and scientists. In recent years, it has motivated major research efforts. Alas, these efforts have not brought positive results. Are we surprised? Professor of biochemistry by the name of Isaac Asimov wrote in a book, and this is writing, by the way, about Carl Sagan, and in reviewing Carl's work called Intelligent Life in the Universe, he says there are so many books on extraterrestrial life that they would almost seem to be a cottage industry. This is in a way surprising, since we have absolutely no evidence that any such phenomenon as life on other worlds exists. Now, I want you to notice here, this is not written by some crazy creationist out there. This is written by a man who believes in evolution. But he's honest. He's honest. He tells it like it is. And I think this is very important and very telling. In an article on being optimistic about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, American scientists and astronomers, David Schwartzman and J. Lee Ricard wrote the following. Is it still reasonable to be optimistic about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence? After all, researchers around the world have been listening for electromagnetic signals from other civilizations in the universe for more than 25 years, using ever larger telescopes and increasingly sophisticated equipment. And then they quote from a fellow named Frank Tipler, who's a cosmologist, estimates that 120,000 hours of observing time have been spent on the search with, of course, no positive results. No. You see why the funding dried up for SETI, don't you? All this money was being spent. Nothing. Not a thing. A writer of popular expositions of scientific topics by the name of David Sobel wrote an article for Life magazine entitled, "Is Anybody Out There?" And he was discussing the work of Dr. Jill Tartar, who was NASA's project scientist and the agency's chief administrative officer, and with regard to SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, okay? And listen to what he says about here. He says, for all her childhood fascination with interstellar travel, Jill Tartar, now 48, would be the first to tell you that interterrestrials have never visited Earth and probably never will. SETI researchers dismiss flying saucer reports and alien abduction stories. Most do not believe that travel over vast distances in space is possible or desirable. Excuse me, the energy required for sending bodies through space, unlike radio waves that have no mass, numbs the minds of even the most nimble scientists. Conservative estimates indicate that a spaceship carrying 10 people and traveling 5 light years to and from a nearby star system at 70% the speed of light, hold on, would consume 500,000 times the amount of energy used in the United States in 1 year. So it's a little impractical, is it not? Just a little bit impractical. But some say, well, now, preacher, you said we're going to talk about the Bible. Let's talk about the Bible in this regard. Well, let's do that. Let's talk about it. What, if anything, does the Bible have to say about this subject? Well, an astute Bible student, of course, would have to say the silence of the Scriptures is deafening on this matter, because the Scriptures don't address it at all. And the biblical record does not affirm the existence of extraterrestrial life in any form. Now, I want you to notice here, we're using the word extraterrestrial here to denote beings with physical makeups as opposed to spiritual beings that we read about in the Scriptures who are called angels or messengers of God. That's different. But, now remember what I said, the silence is deafening, all right? But the Bible does make many positive statements about the earth and the universe. Many positive statements. And in those statements, it is clear that the earth has been appointed a very unique role in God's creation. The psalmist in Psalm 115 and verse 16 said, "The heaven, even the heavens, are the Lord's. But the earth he has given to the children of men." You ever wonder why we haven't colonized the moon? You know why? It's quite simple. The atmosphere is not conducive to man living there. The only way man can live there is to take his own environment with him. And that is a bit of a challenge. It's a bit of a challenge. And no other planet has been found that even if we could get to it, would in and of itself sustain man. And so that's a very important point to keep in mind. The earth, then, we learn, was apparently created uniquely for mankind. Keep this in mind. Paul, in Acts 17, verses 24 through 26, talks about God who made the world and everything in it. Since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he has made from one blood of every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings. Isn't that interesting? Why didn't God say something about those folks living on that planet out there somewhere? Why didn't he say that? Well, because they're not there. Just as simple as that. We understand the principle of the silence of the scriptures, don't we? God, when he told Noah how to build the ark, he didn't say, okay, Noah, now I don't want you to use pine, I don't want you to use oak, and I don't want you to use redwood, and name off every kind of conceivable wood, and then get down to the one he wanted him to use. He didn't do that, did he? He simply said, use gopher wood, and that's it. And by the way, whether this is to be interpreted as the way the wood was cut, which some have thought, or the actual type of the wood, which others believe to be more plausible, it doesn't matter. He specified, and what did that do? It eliminated everything else. And when we're told that God gives life and breath to everyone and has made all of one blood of every nation to dwell on the face of the earth, and he has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings or habitations, that settles it. There's no one else to be considered. No one else to be considered. And it is of interest to note that many celestial bodies mentioned in the scriptures, like the moon and the sun and the stars, are spoken of as having definite purposes. Now, this is important. If the purpose of these things we see up here in the sky, if the purpose of them is for the habitation of intelligent life beyond the earth, then we should know about this because God created it. But notice this now. The sun and the moon have been spoken of as lights, Genesis 1:14, to guide or to be useful for marking the days and the seasons and the years. They serve a useful purpose, don't they? Let there be lights in the firmaments of the heavens that divide the day from the night, and let them be for a sign and seasons and days and years. Then we're informed in 1 Corinthians 15:41, there's one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars. For one star differs from another in glory. Well, what does that mean? Well, you look up at the sky and you figure that out pretty quick, don't you? Especially on a beautiful, clear night. You get away from all the lights of the city and you look up at God's handiwork. Takes your breath away, doesn't it? And well, it should. But no celestial body except earth is spoken of as being a dwelling place for mankind. That's it. That's it. Furthermore, the earth is unique in that Christ's activities are described as having occurred on this planet, not on some other planet. It was on the earth that the Godhead became incarnate, John chapter 1, beginning with verse 1. It was on the earth that Christ died for the sins of mankind. Now notice, it doesn't say he died for the sins of extraterrestrial beings. It doesn't say that. It was on the earth that his bodily resurrection occurred, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And it is from the earth that he ascended to his Father in heaven. He didn't get on a spaceship and travel to some other planet. Read it. See? Now, that's what the Bible tells us. That's what we have to go on, is what information we have. While the men were standing there looking steadfastly up toward heaven, he went up. That's it. They saw him leaving in the clouds. That's it. In Ephesians chapter 4, beginning with verse 8, Paul says, when he ascended on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts to men. Now this, he ascended, what does it mean? But that he first also descended to the lower parts of the earth. He who descended is also the one who ascended far above all the heavens, that he might fulfill all things. He didn't stop out here on some planet on his way. He went beyond all of it. He went beyond all of it. But there's also another aspect that I believe needs to be considered in light of this. And that is what the Bible clearly teaches us about God. The Bible clearly tells us that God is love. Now, love, of course, allows freedom of choice. And that is exactly what God gave man from the beginning, is it not? That's why we're not living in the Garden of Eden anymore. Because man had freedom of choice. Joshua recognized this when he said to the people of Israel, choose this day whom you will serve. You choose. You have an option to choose. Jesus recognized this in John chapter 5, verses 39 and 40. He said, you search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and these are they which testify of me, but you are not willing to come to me that you might have life. You made the choice. You made the decision. Now, since God is the creator of the universe, as we noted in Genesis chapter 1, and since God is likewise no respecter of persons, as we find in just one of the places we find, Acts chapter 10, verse 34, were he to create other intelligent life, his loving nature would require that freedom of choice be granted to such life forms. And it also follows that since God is loving, that he would offer instruction to such intelligent beings, just as he has to man, so that he could make the proper use of his freedom of choice. Creatures then, possessing free moral agency, are not perfected, and they make mistakes. Such mistakes are violations of God's instructions that require justice to be administered. God is not only loving, is he? But he's just. And he's merciful. And he institutes a way for those who are separated from him as a result of their own sins to return. But the scriptures teach that there's only one way to stand justified before God. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes unto the Father except by me. John chapter 14 and verse 6. Now, I want you to take note of something here. We read a little bit. I don't know how this happens, but thanks to Edward this morning, he read some of the passages I'm going to refer to right now. But the angelic host is referred to over there in Hebrews chapter 2. And while they possessed freedom of choice, from what we know of the scriptures, they were not allowed the opportunity due to being a completely spiritual being by nature, and to the fact that angels has experienced God's glory firsthand as they stood in his presence, they were without excuse for their rebellion against God's authority. And thus, when Christ died, he didn't die for the angels. Read that over carefully in Hebrews 2. You'll see what I mean. He does not give aid to the angels, Hebrews 2 verse 16, but he does give aid to the seed of Abraham. That's talking about Christ's death on the cross. The scriptures also speak of one more important point that it ties right into this, and that is that Christ, oh, I forgot to put that up, I'm sorry, Christ died once for all. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 27, and also chapter 9 and verse 28. The wording of the original Greek is explicit regarding Christ's death. It was once for all never to be repeated. That's it. That's what it means. Creatures possessing freedom of choice make mistakes in attempting to carry out God's will. There's no question about it. And forgiveness of those transgressions only comes through Christ. John 14 and verse 6, which you already talked about a few moments ago. Now, since Christ died only once, it is important for us to see a seeming violation of Scripture if we suggest at any point that somehow Jesus went planet hopping to die again and again and again and again and again and again for all these creatures that God created out there. There again, what do the Scriptures say? Silence of the Scriptures. He died once for all without need of repetition. These biblical principles should never be overlooked in any discussion concerning the existence of extraterrestrial life. Now, the only conclusion then that we can draw is that science has produced no credible evidence of intelligent life in outer space. There have been many speculations and many opinions, but empirical evidence for the existence of extraterrestrial life is completely lacking. Period. Period. There is no evidence whatsoever. And that includes Area 51. There is no evidence. It is speculation that is, to say the least, vain and worthless to even speculate on such things. So from a biblical perspective then, there's no reason for us to believe that intelligent life could exist beyond this earth. For God so loved the, you know what it says, the world. Did you ever think about what that says? It doesn't say the universe. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. God has promised salvation to mankind, not to E.T. Not to E.T., as cute as he may seem to be. But you know, this is something that a long time ago, whenever E.T., the movie was so popular and people were so enthralled with the technology that they used to make this creature look so alive, this was something that came up many times. And that is that E.T. is only fantasy. There is no reality whatsoever in it. And don't allow yourself to be caught up in fantasy and start living in a dream world. You know, there's a lot of things that growing up that I thought were pretty real to me. You know, Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote, you know. I thought, boy, we just miss a lot that goes on out there in the desert, you know. But that's not real. That's not real. No coyote's having a safe dropped on him from the top of a hill and then get up and take off running again. No, no, no. That's fantasy. And it's every bit as fantastic as the idea of extraterrestrial life. Biblically, I do not believe that we can say that there is anything intelligent living beyond the boundaries that God has set, and that is the face of this earth. And that presents enough problems of its own, quite frankly. I apologize for the length of the lesson, but Lauren's going to preach this afternoon, and he hopefully will give us a break. Hope you'll be back and listen to the good lesson that he's prepared. I know he's put a lot of effort into it. And there again, Lauren, I didn't infringe on your subject again, see? Okay, we had a deal when he decided what he was going to preach on that I wouldn't touch on it until after he preached on it. So, appreciate your careful attention this morning. And I know that there's still probably questions about other things or particulars that I didn't cover. I apologize for it. I started with about 18 pages of notes, trimmed it down to 10, and that's as far as I could go. So I did the best I could in this particular effort, and I hope that it's been beneficial to each one of you. If you're with us this morning and not yet a Christian, we want you to know that we care about your eternal soul so much that we're going to make an opportunity available right now for you to ask people to hear your confession of faith in Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the true and living God, coming from a penitent heart, and be buried with your Lord in baptism this very hour for your remission of sins. And if you're a child of God who's sinned, we stand always ready to pray with you and pray for you as you confess your sins to our Father and ask for his forgiveness. Whatever obligation to God might be, we hope you'll use this opportunity and come while we stand and sing together.